Zapatistas broadcasting live on Berkeley Liberation Radio from Oakland, California. We're here every first Sunday of every month broadcasting the Política de Abajo y a la Izquierda in Mexico and in the United States and all over the world, talking about the struggles of those below and to the left who don't go through the official politics of the electoral politics and the official politics of Arriba and the people of above. This month we're going to be talking about a number of issues, including the judicial system in Mexico, as well as some stuff about the judicial system here in California, returning to the topic of Oscar Grant. And you can call us at any time during this show. The phone number is 510-495-1666. Again, the phone number in the studio at Berkeley Liberation Radio is 510-495-1666. 1666. Call us and give us any comments, questions, advice, criticism, anything that you want to tell us, ask us, and we can talk about it. You can also send us an email at relatoszapatistas at gmail.com, and we're able to talk about any sort of thing that you are curious about. So we're going to begin this month's show with an introduction that we prepared that sort of sets the scene and is going to frame some of the issues that we're going to be trying to talk about on the show.
So the theme of the show is entitled Boundary Tactics and Trials, the Remix. And for this month of August 2010, we return to the themes we introduced in the last two shows, Boundary Tactics and Trials. Last month, we discussed the Mexican Supreme Court's decision to free 12 political prisoners from Atenco. After 4 years of unjust incarceration, While this certainly represents a victory in the struggle for justice for the hundreds who suffered brutal repression at the hands of Mexican police in the first days of May 2006, we feel it is important to remain conscious and critical of the deep violence perpetuated by the Mexican justice system and so many others around the world. While we celebrate the liberation of our compañeros from Atenco, we remember the 4 years of freedom taken from them and the incalculable suffering of the dozens of women who were sexually assaulted by police officers, the countless families whose homes were raided, the many journalists attacked, and the two young men who lost their lives and were taken by police. And so today we will focus on our discussion of the Mexican justice system on the depth of what John Ross calls flagrant inequities.
On our 4th of July show, we also discussed another trial, that of former police officer Johannes Meserle, who shot and killed 22-year-old Oscar Grant at the Fruitvale BART station on January 1, 2009. At that point, we were following the developments in the trial as the city of Oakland prepared for the much-anticipated public response to any verdict. And on July 8, the people of Oakland and the Bay Area rose up in outrage over the jury's decision to convict Oscar Grant's murderer of the light charge of involuntary manslaughter. The people's outcry and the state and the police's response will be our focus in our follow-up discussion of this case today.
Since the spring, we've been following with great concern the struggle in Arizona over the passing of SB 1070 and related legislation, anticipating the date of its formal implementation, July 29, 2010. As we all know, SB 1070 makes it a crime to be undocumented in Arizona, essentially encouraging racial profiling and creating a heightened climate of fear for immigrant communities across the state. This fear and insecurity has been felt across the nation as well, as concern builds about the possible spread of similar legislation in other states. The July 29th date for the implementation of the law was reclaimed by activists and organizers as a national day of action against SB 1070 and in solidarity with the people of Arizona. And as preparations were underway for the mobilizations, a federal judge ruled against the legitimacy of the, quote, most controversial elements of SB 1070, placing a temporary injunction on the enforcement of certain elements of the law. So as with the case of the Atenco prisoners, while we celebrate the small victory, we do so cautiously and critically, understanding the real threat still posed by the temporary and partial nature of this court decision and the grave reality of the other parts of the law that are still intact, as well as similar laws like the Federal Secure Communities, or SCOM, program. Today we'll hear from folks who rose up on Thursday to speak out against the crisis of U.S. immigration policy and about why the problem we face is not one of immigration, but a problem of capitalism, in the words of a Phoenix Guerrilla billboard on Thursday.
And so today we will revisit the question of trials, both in Mexico and here locally, as we consider the ways that people's mobility and liberty are continually and increasingly limited and even criminalized through the militarization of borders and the state's attempt to create divisions and instill fear in our communities. In addressing this, we will focus on tactics employed by Los de Abajo everywhere, as people collectively develop creative approaches to reclaiming our right to move freely with dignity in our struggles for survival and the precarious and violent conditions of globalized capitalism.
With Relato Zapatista here at Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM, and we're broadcasting from someplace in the Bay Area. And we forgot to mention that here in the studio is DJ Alita, DJ Profe, I'm DJ Kayla, and DJ Filemon. And so we're all here on this first Sunday, and we're here every first Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. If you at any time have any questions, call us at 510-495-1666, and any comments or questions are much appreciated. We're going to move into our sort of consistent month in Zapatista history segment, where we try to keep up on our memory of the Zapatista struggle, and we encourage everyone to, if you haven't read up on Zapatista history, that we should stay informed, and we should also be staying informed about the local history here in the Bay Area and different movements happening here. So this is for the month of August. Back in 1994, the Zapatistas hold the National Democratic Convention. Over 6,000 people attended at the first Aguascalientes. And of course, this is also when Ernesto Zedillo is elected president. This is just months after the initial uprising of the Zapatistas. In 1995, the Zapatistas hold the first international consulta. Over 1 million people vote, calling for the EZLN to transform itself into an independent political force. In 96, the Zapatistas organized the first intercontinental Encuentro for Humanity and against neoliberalism. And again, thousands of people from around the world attend. In 99, the military deploys paratroopers and forces to occupy the remote village of Amador Hernandez, the final link in plans to build a road that will encircle the Zapatistas in the La Candona jungle. The community resists with nonviolent protests, but the military encampment remains. In 2002, paramilitary activity escalates again with the assassination of a number of Zapatista authorities. In 2003, the Zapatistas announced the death of the Aguas Calientes and the birth of the Caracoles. We also know them as the Juntas of Buen Gobierno or Juntas of Good Government. This marks a major formalization of the Zapatistas' autonomous communities. In effect, the Zapatistas enact the San Andreas Accords within the territory they control. Because this is such an important piece, I'm also going to read a little bit from a news article that John Ross wrote in 2003, the same month that this announcement came out. And he writes, in a series of 9 communiques published between July 22nd and August 1st, the Zapatistas laid out innovations designed to strengthen the autonomous structure of the EZLN is building in the jungle and highlands of southeastern Chiapas, in defiance of the Mexican Congress mutilation of an Indian rights law signed by the rebels and the representatives of then Presidente Ernesto Zedillo in 1996 that would have granted limited autonomy to the nation's 57 distinct Indian peoples. To this effect, several thousand members of what the EZLN terms civil society braved the mountain rains and mud to journey to the Oventi Quejido above San Cristobal de las Casas during August 8th through 10th of 2003. The reorganization is as practical as it is conceptual. In a real sense, the success of the Aguas Calientes spelled their demise. So the Aguas Calientes were these 5 centers that were where a lot of the clinics and libraries were being built, but the NGOs were kind of taking over these centers or putting a lot of money into them, which was creating a disparity within the Zapatista communities. Therefore, the good government councils were a way of overseeing that the Zapatista communities remained horizontal, and where the Zapatistas were better able to organize with the NGOs and structure the way NGOs came into the communities. In 2004, August 2004, on the first anniversary of the Caracoles, the Zapatistas released a series of communiques about the progress and struggles of the movement. They detail how their autonomous communities are governed and admit that in most communities, Zapatista women still haven't obtained equal status with men. So we encourage you all to, if anything that we said was interesting, look it up. You can Google it. You can go to Enlace Zapatista. You can go to the Peace House website and get more information about Zapatista history.
So for a little bit more current history, for the month of July in Oaxaca, at approximately 12:15 p.m. on July 30th, over 100 Oaxaca State Police raided the autonomous municipality of San Juan Copala. Approximately 30 heavily armed members of the Union for the Social Well-Being of the Triqui region, UBISORT, a paramilitary organization, accompanied the police on the raid. Rufino Juarez, UBISORT's leader, reportedly participated in the raid. The goal of this raid, according to the state government, was to remove the body of Anastasio Juarez Hernandez, who was the brother of Rufino Juarez, who was the actual, you could say, leader or the agent of the municipality of San Juan Copala, but he wasn't really elected. He was appointed by the UBISORT paramilitary organization. Police did remove the dead body from his home, and then left San Juan Copala. However, the paramilitaries, taking advantage of the police presence, took over the town of the town hall of San Juan Copala. The town hall is now occupied by 30 UBISORT paramilitaries armed with automatic assault rifles. They have taken over control of the entire town. Meanwhile, the Mexican military has deployed soldiers in La Sabana, a nearby town that is controlled by UBISORT. Thus far, the soldiers have not entered San Juan Copala. 2 young indigenous Triqui women were wounded when the paramilitaries and police entered San Juan Copala. The women were part of the human blockade at the entrance to the town who were attempting to impede the police and paramilitary access. The 2 women, ages 15 and 18, were gravely wounded when paramilitaries from UBISOR shot them and entered San Juan Copala. The women were evacuated and are being treated at an undisclosed location. This town, San Juan Copale, has been occupied heavily by armed UBSOR paramilitaries who were escorted by the state police. To add insult to the injury, the raid comes after 7 months of a paramilitary blockage that the government has claimed it is incapable of breaking, despite the autonomous municipality's claims that residents may starve to death if the blockade continues.
And also part of our Zapatista history, a collective from Mexico, the Red Contra Represión, has announced a campaign, 1,000 Rages, One Heart, the Zapatista Communities Live. And they say, although the repression has been constant and increased as 2010 approached, starting in 2009 with events in Bachajón and a new phase of attacks against the Zapatista communities. These attacks in various parts of Zapatista territory in which there are economic interests at stake are intended to put an end to the Zapatista struggle. What they propose is a campaign to put an end to the harassment of the Zapatista communities to be known as 1,000 Rages but One Heart. Its objectives are to counter the strategy of disinformation and lies, to denounce those responsible at various levels of government, and to spread the word about the struggle of the EZLN, its history, the process of construction of autonomy, and the proposal of the 6th Declaration. And this proposal, they ask that on August 16th, National International Day of Banners, or Mantas, on that day we all fill the streets with banners, either fixed or carried to different locations. We propose that everyone documents and records their actions in the best way they can so that once the day is over, information can be sent to Enlace Zapatista and we can spread information about what we have done. We are looking to the date of November 17th, which is the anniversary of the founding of the EZLN, as a day to work towards in the medium term for national international action decided from the proposals and coordinated efforts over the previous 4 months. Finally, we think that this campaign could serve to reinforce existing workspaces, and we hope it will help build new ways of collective working and coordination between adherents to the 6th Declaration of the Lacandona Jungle. We have opened a website for the campaign with the idea that there we can share materials, drawings, information, etc., to use in the campaign, as well as proposing and calling for coordinated actions and reporting actions which have taken place. The page is milesderabias.blogspot.com, and you can send anything that you want to share to milesderabias@gmail.com, and they'll upload it for you. So this is a word from our compas in Mexico who are adherents to the other campaign, just as we are here at Relato Zapatista. We're going to go on to a musical break, and when we come back, we have a very special interview, in-studio interview, live for y'all, going over the judicial system in Mexico, and also to talk about what we can do and actions we can take.
I don't even know. Yo, we was on the beat on this boardwalk. My man Bixby visiting from New York. Wanted a dope spot to spark light at. On the low coffin, talking about the tropics, politics, and popping. How to make them all match what we saw. Had to be about 5'10 dimes holding their shoes and skirts, walking the white sands. I scanned the paradisiacal picture right up until I hit her eyes. Damn, reminded me of the image I had of what enticed the Española to take over these lands. I stepped forth, then hesitant yet confident. Not that I could blend with any picture of a colonist. Her crew responsive when Bixby talked to them. She do a part and smiled at my introduction. I said, un placer, como tu te llamaba? She said, todavía me conoce como Ana. Gaona, estaba salvaje like fauna. She made me wanna rock the mic for her. She left me comatose like an overdose or an hechizo. Me hizo cara la lona. A la gaona, yo, salvaje like fauna. Make me wanna rock the mic for her. She seemed like an epiphany, word out, yo. Straight out the dreams of history, even the books torn. She put her hand on my shoulder, reflect the sand from off of her feet. I said, that's the edit. She said, New York love, half Bolivian and half Quiqueya. Mother from San Sebastian, father from Villamella. So she was raised up between and Barrio and Washington Heights. A monument to what it was like. I said, so how you dig a PR? She said, I'd rather DR. No dollars, but they don't bother us for who we are. Which caught me completely off guard. She knew what was partly Dominique and partway. Yo, where she just talked about the prejudice in Puerto Rico. Confused silence, it must have been the weed smoke. She giggled, cause you Dominican, right? Well, I said, half plus Mexican, then just the lyricist at night. Speaking of which, you might wanna come through with your friends. Here's a flyer, we got a gig tonight up at Pier 10. She pulled up her hair, then I knew I was a guana. She made me wanna rock the mic for her. She left me comatose like an overdose or an hechizo. Me hizo cara la lona, a la gaona. Yo, salvaje like fauna. make me wanna rock the mic for her. She seemed like an epiphany, word up, yo. Straight out the dream to history, living the books to one of these. The name to the flow to what is and close under what said. She was sipping from a drink when I was done. Met me at the bar with sweaty, but she wiped my forehead. Like when we in a couple of days later. Not rushing, but her vacation made it something urgent. But since ain't nothing perfect, my defense mechanisms to build up walls while others hurting. But she wanted to burst in through them. So when I stayed away, she complained I didn't know what she's worth. Well, if you close up, you never know when love is happening. Well, I said I don't throw that word around melodramatically. Can it be that you're scared? Yo, most certainly. The rose curse will be residing on this tropical rock. Cause how are you not gonna mess with me mentally if your destiny is becoming a memory? Yeah, especially since the thought of you is like a sauna. You made me wanna rock the mic for ya. You left me comatose like an overdose or an edgy song. Me siente cara la lona, anacaona, daba salvaje like fauna. Made me wanna rock the mic for ya. You seem like an epiphany, word up. Straight out the dreams of history, you left the books torn up.
Escuchando Relato Zapatista en la radio Berkeley Liberation aquí en el área de la Bahía. Estamos aquí en el estudio y vamos a tener una discusión hoy de un documental que se llama Presunto Culpable. Ese documental fue hecho por Roberto Hernández y Laida Negrete y fue presentado la semana pasada en PBS, en la estación de televisión pública aquí en los Estados Unidos. Este documental, Presunto Culpable, ha ganado varios premios a nivel nacional e internacional y hoy vamos a hablar con la directora política del documental sobre el caso que sigue.
Esta es una llamada proveniente del reclusorio. Si acepta la llamada, marque 1.
¿Qué es lo que está pasando con la justicia en México?
Que acabamos de escuchar fue un clip de audio del trailer del documental que se presentó la semana pasada en PBS. Y aquí tenemos en el estudio con nosotros a Nat Schenker Osorio, que es la directora política del documental. Y bueno, directora política es una posición interesante porque uno de los temas en que nos vamos a enfocar en esa entrevista es el hecho de que el documental se está utilizando como, digamos, un instrumento político, ¿no? Para sacar ciertos, cambios legales, ¿no? En el sistema judicial de México. Entonces, es interesante para empezar que el documental se presenta o se plantea como una estrategia política para utilizar. Entonces, pero bueno, además, aparte de eso, el documental es excelente y está bien, muy, muy, muy bien producido y muy impactante. Entonces, bueno, bienvenida al estudio.
Gracias por tenerme.
No, y gracias por estar aquí. Entonces, bueno, la primera pregunta sería que básicamente nos expliques un poquito del caso, ¿no? Que se presenta en el documental y, ¿no? Cómo es, o sea, cómo va, ¿no? El argumento de la película.
Sí, pero ante todo quiero agradecer a ustedes por tenerme aquí en el estudio y gracias por esa oportunidad de hablar un poquito con el público sobre esa película que para mí, por lo menos, fue sumamente impactante. Y al verlo, bueno, básicamente hablé al día siguiente con Roberto y Laida, que son la fuerza detrás de esta película, y dije, wow, no sé si quieren mi ayuda, pero tienen mi ayuda, porque aquí estoy, quiero hacer algo con ustedes. Y esto es precisamente porque es tan poderoso la historia, tan poderosa la historia que se presenta aquí. Es el caso de una persona, se llama Toño, bueno, su apodo es Toño, Antonio Zúñiga, que está en la cárcel bajo una sentencia por 20 años por supuestamente haber matado a alguien, un crimen que tiene mucho que ver con problemas de maras. Y lo que pasa fue que es que Toño no estaba ni cerca de donde tomó lugar este crimen. Y a pesar de que Toño tiene como 10, 20 personas testigos de que él estaba todo el día en su puesto en el mercado vendiendo durante el tiempo en que se mató esta persona, a la policía esto no les importa. Además, no hay ninguna evidencia. Y es más, cuando le hacen a Toño un examen físico para ver si tiene polvo del balazo, resulta negativo. Pero a pesar de eso, y a pesar de que el único testigo al crimen, las primeras dos veces que la policía le toma su historia, él nunca menciona a Toño, solo menciona a Toño la tercera vez, cuando la policía ya han, como, no dicho exactamente, pero han dejado por saber que tal vez el testigo es de verdad el culpable. De repente, él nombra a Toño. Y la policía lo agarra, y durante el transcurso de la película es básicamente la filmación del nuevo jurado que Roberto y Laida, que son pareja que viven aquí en el área de la bahía ahora, que están en Berkeley estudiando, es el jurado de nuevo de Toño y lo que logran hacer ellos por buscar justicia en este caso donde no hay.
Es interesante porque, bueno, o sea, es un ejemplo de caso, ¿no? Porque el documental se enfoca en el caso de Toño, pero realmente está hablando del sistema entero, el sistema judicial entero, ¿no? De México.
Sí,
porque
precisamente.
En el documental se presentan varias estadísticas, como por ejemplo el hecho de que el 95% de las sentencias son condenatorias, o sea que resultan en convicciones. Es un porcentaje increíble, y que el 92% de las acusaciones carecen de evidencia física, o sea que solamente se basan en testigos, ¿no? Entonces, nos pareció muy impactante la representación de la corte en el documental, es decir, cómo se llevan los procesos jurídicos, la interacción entre el juez, el acusado, los abogados y los testigos, la documentación del proceso y todo eso, ¿no? Entonces, como extrapolando un poquito del caso de Toño, ¿cómo funciona el sistema jurídico en México, ¿no? Hablando específicamente de esa escena que ocurre, ¿no? En la sala de audiencias.
Sí, gracias por la pregunta, porque la verdad, por el lado bueno, Toño es una persona tan carismática, con una luz por dentro, tan obvio, que esta película podría llegar a ver como el caso especial de una persona. Y Toño es una persona muy especial, pero Toño es, como dices, es un ejemplo de lo que está pasando en el sistema. Y para una persona que viene de acá, ver el jurado, yo he visto varios jurados aquí en los Estados, es bastante extraño ver el jurado que se presenta allá en la película. Roberto y Laida consiguieron permiso de filmar todo, y bueno, de hecho es interesante la razón por qué tienen permiso a ser un jurado de nuevo. Resulta que el primer abogado de Toño, que fue nombrado por el Estado por falta de dinero para su defensa, no fue abogado de verdad, había falsificado sus papeles. Entonces, por este, digamos, suerte, si se puede decir eso, ellos tienen por qué pedir otro jurado. A no ser eso, no hubiera tenido chance, a pesar de que no había nada de evidencia contra Toño. Bueno, entonces en el jurado se miran varias cosas que, para usar las palabras de Roberto en particular, obligan que el sistema en México no pueda ser un sistema de presuntamiento de inocencia, que es la base, como es lo más básico para un sistema de juicio que es para la gente y que sirve. Y una de estas cosas es que los juicios que ocurren al lado de la prisión. O sea, Toño, ya que él es está en la prisión, él aparece en corte detrás de, en su jaula básicamente, que está al lado del corte, pasa por un túnel de donde está viviendo, digamos, sobreviviendo, mejor dicho, y él aparece en toda su ropa de, bueno, parece criminal. Y él está detrás de unas barras, está en su jaula, y él está obligado a escuchar el corte de ahí. De allá, el procedimiento por la ley y el costumbre en México es que no se permite introducir, presentar argumentos, evidencia nueva que no haya sido presentado en el primer caso. O sea, todos los funcionarios del corte, el juez, que vale la pena decir, le toca a Toño el mismo juez que le condenó la primera vez, y la abogada, es mujer en la película, en este caso, para la prosecución contra Toño, y el defensor que brinde su servicio gratis como favor para Roberto Hileda, y también porque el caso es tan obvio y tan injusto. Bueno, ellos no tienen permiso decir cosas que no hayan dicho la primera vez. Y como el primer abogado, el que no era abogado legal, básicamente no defendió a Toño para nada, entonces el nuevo abogado, por bueno que es, no tiene permiso, y cada vez que él intenta hablar, el juez no lo deja. También, por la forma en que toman récords, el juez está obligado a repetir cada cosa dicha por cualquier otra persona para que lo puedan escribir. Entonces, bueno, es difícil describirlo por radio, es una cosa que hay que ver porque no es de creer si no lo han visto. Parece más como un teatro, como un teatro absurdista, como alguien que escribiría un, no sé, alguien de la época de Sartre. No parece real, pero ahí está. Y básicamente todos tienen sus papeles, y lo interesante es que la única persona que tiene permiso hablar, así hablar abiertamente, decir lo que quiere decir, es Toño. Entonces lo que transcurre en la película es que Toño llega a ser su propio abogado, y creo que los que hicieron la película lo describen mejor, lo llaman hacer cirugía en uno mismo, porque Toño obviamente no es abogado, esto no es su formación, y básicamente Roberto y Laida se hicieron obligados a mandar a Toño en la cárcel un libro sobre las leyes en México, y Toño en su tiempo libre en la cárcel tuvo que aprender cómo ser abogado y defenderse.
Bien, sí, ¿no? Es un caso sumamente interesante que revela tantas inconsistencias y contradicciones dentro del mismo sistema. Bueno, aquí en Relatos Zapatistas seguimos con mucho cuidado los procesos que llevan los medios alternativos independientes, ¿no? Viendo cómo la radio, el periodismo, el cine también son armas muy importantes en esos días para seguir en la lucha pues contra el poder, ¿no? Y sabemos que hay una historia específicamente muy importante de cine politizado en América Latina, en la cual la cámara de video se entiende como una arma que se puede utilizar en la lucha por la justicia, ¿no? Eso lo vemos desde los años 50. Este documental, Presunto Culpable, claramente forma parte de esa tradición, ¿no? Y es interesante que es un documental binacional, de alguna forma, ¿no? Entonces, nos parece que en el documental hay por lo menos dos operaciones tácticas. La primera toma la forma del documental mismo como una manera de ponerles presión a los actores políticos, ¿no? Es decir, como una palanca mediática. La otra forma que toma es de cómo se usa la cámara en la corte misma como aparato de contabilidad y responsabilidad, es decir, como una palanca verídica, ¿no? Que la cámara documenta cosas que nadie más quiere recordar. Entonces, ¿cómo entiendes tú, como directora política, ¿no? de este proceso, este proyecto, la función política, jurídica y social, tanto de la cámara como del documental mismo, y pensando en su función en México y también aquí en los Estados Unidos, que obviamente tiene una resonancia distinta, ¿no? Entonces,
Hay tantas respuestas a esa pregunta, espero no olvidarme en el laberinto de mis respuestas, pero me pueden decir si me desvío.
Claro.
Esta película pretende hacer algo un poco diferente que otros documentales, y la verdad la razón porque me atrajo y yo quería trabajar con eso, pues precisamente porque esta película, hay tantas cosas horribles que están pasando en nuestro mundo y ustedes saben, no tengo que hacer la lista aquí. Y con estas cosas horribles, posibles documentales que se podrían hacer para enseñar lo que está pasando. Y para mí la diferencia con Presunto Culpable es que esa es una película de una solución. Claro, parcial, imperfecto, pero es una solución. Y la solución, como es casi a nivel metafísico, es la cámara. Y la película es la prueba de esta solución. Y de hecho, lo que está tratando de lograr la película, la película para los que lo hicieron, es un vehículo. Ellos no pretenden a ser grandes estrellas de cine, aunque lo podrían ser, porque la verdad tiene valor artístico. Esta película está muy bien hecha y es entretenida, no es como vale la pena verla. Pero esto no es el punto. El punto es hacer cambio al sistema. Y el cambio número uno que ellos están buscando ahorita es precisamente pasar una ley de que tienen que haber cámaras, tienen que recordar todas las interrogaciones policiales y todos los jurados criminales en México. Esto de tener cámaras, sobre todo en las interrogaciones de policía, se considera lo más mínimo a nivel internacional para tener juicios justos. Y tal vez esto suena muy caro o muy avanzado, pero la verdad, tener unas cuantas cámaras en un país llega a ser una de las soluciones más baratas, porque no requiere entrenar personal, no requiere muchas capacitaciones, y ahorita la tecnología es tan común que tener unas cuantas cámaras, bueno, más que unas cuantas, México es un país grande y hay mucha policía, pero esta, la verdad, es una de las soluciones como más sencillas que hay, y es tener un récord de lo que está haciendo esa policía en el cuarto privado cuando tiene esta persona que han recogido en la calle, en el caso de Toño, y le están haciendo preguntas para saber exactamente cuáles preguntas, cómo responde la persona, porque después lo que ellos toman en evidencia en el caso es simplemente el relato de la policía. Esto es lo que se hace ahorita. No hay ningún récord objetivo. Entonces, por una parte, esto es el punto. El punto es hacer al público, sobre todo mexicano, aunque el público norteamericano también importa, estadounidense, debo decir. Pero también el punto es dejar a la gente saber lo que pasa, lo que está pasando, lo que es demasiado común. Una de las cosas más interesantes que ha pasado con esa película, por ejemplo, cuando se dio la película en el Festival de Morelia en México, después de la película había una sesión de preguntas y respuestas, y ahí de la nada se levantó alguien, lágrimas en sus ojos, diciendo que él iba a decir por primera vez algo en público que nunca había dicho, y eso era que él también había sido detenido de la misma forma que Toño. Y esto es lo que pasa a la gente. Esto pasó en una oficina en San Francisco con un estadounidense que había sido detenido. O sea, la gente está diciendo al ver la película cosas que son tan comunes que casi cada mexicano conoce a alguien o conoce a alguien que conoce a alguien. Pero esta cosa ha estado en silencio hasta ahorita, porque todos creen que por algo lo detuvieron, por algo estuvo en la cárcel. No puede ser que solo fue inocente. Eso no me pasó a mí. Entonces, esto se ha quedado bajo como una sábana, si se puede decir, de no de culpabilidad, sino de como, ¿qué es la palabra que estoy buscando? Silencio.
Silencio.
Sí. Y esta película, si al ver la película, esto ayuda a la gente a sentir, mira, eso me pasó a mí, eso pasó a mi primo, eso pasó a mi hermano, mi amigo, mi vecino. Esto es lo que pasa. Esto no tiene que ver con nosotros, con la gente, y sobre todo con la gente que no tiene poder, que no tiene dinero, que está vendiendo en el mercado. Esto es el sistema en que vivimos. Entonces, tal vez esto les da la oportunidad y el como la libertad de poder declarar lo que está pasando y declarar de que esto no está bien y esto no puede seguir pasando. Y disculpa que estoy contestando tanto, pero la misma película muestra que esta solución tiene validez, porque en el último jurado, como ustedes se acuerdan, ustedes que están aquí conmigo, que han visto la película, el mismo juez dice que fue por el hecho de haber visto la película del otro jurado que ellos decidieron lo que decidieron, y no quiero decir porque ustedes tienen que ver la película. Pero sí,
o sea, incluso el policía, el jefe de policía, el detective que viene a testificar en contra de Tonio en la película, dice que se siente físicamente amenazado por la presencia de las cámaras en la sala de audiencia. Entonces, sí. Él dice, en algún momento del jurado, dice, si a mí me hacen algo, ¿no? Por lo que estoy testificando ahora, yo considero que tú eres el responsable, tú, a Tonio y a los que tienen las cámaras. Entonces, él se siente, sí, realmente la cámara funciona como arma, ¿no? Y la policía lo sabe. Pero quería regresar a algo que decías antes, mencionaste brevemente que en Estados Unidos también, o sea, una parte de del enfoque de tu trabajo es en Estados Unidos, y es por la cantidad de dinero que viene de Estados Unidos para apoyar el sistema jurídico de México, ¿es verdad, no? Porque bajo la iniciativa Mérida, o el plan Mérida, de que hemos hablado en ese programa en el pasado, ¿no? Que apoya militarmente, ¿no? A México para enfrentar, digamos, el narcotráfico, supuestamente. También, por lo visto, apoyan con dinero al sistema jurídico, ¿verdad? Entonces, no sé si podrías hablar un poquito sobre este apoyo financiero que viene de Estados Unidos para el sistema legal en México, y también cuál sería la forma de cambiar, ¿no? Esto desde Estados Unidos.
Sí, es una excelente pregunta. Bueno, como dije, hay varias estrategias usando esa película para tratar de buscar justicia, no solo para Tonio, sino para todos los compañeros de Tonio que se quedaron en la cárcel y no tienen la suerte de tener toda esa gente que quieren hacer otra película, porque esto, la verdad, es una forma muy lenta de sacar persona por persona. Hay que cambiar el sistema en sí, ¿verdad? Y la iniciativa Mérida está apoyando, como ustedes saben, a varios sistemas de justicia, si se puede usar la palabra injusticia ahorita, en México. Y entre ellos es brindar apoyo en forma de dinero. Y la verdad, resulta ser suficiente dinero que ahorita la fuente de dinero de los Estados Unidos es una cantidad más grande en cuanto a lo que cuesta el sistema de juicio en México que lo que brinde el gobierno de México en sí. O sea, es una cantidad bastante grande. Entonces, entre las cosas que pretende hacer la iniciativa Mérida, que como me imagino que ustedes han relatado antes, tiene sus problemas, pero entre sus supuestas metas son la profesionalización y el mejoramiento del sistema. Y esto incluye capacitación de la policía, esto incluye cosas que deben cambiar el sistema para que funcione mejor. Entonces, lo que nosotros estamos tratando de hacer con Roberto y Laida, con otras personas involucradas, es reunirnos directamente con funcionarios de nuestro gobierno aquí en los Estados Unidos, sobre todo las personas en la Casa de Representantes, en el Foreign Affairs Committee, que escribieron la iniciativa Mérida, y tratar de hacerlos llegar a saber lo que está pasando con el sistema. Y no tan indirectamente, se puede casi decir directamente, con el dinero que nosotros aquí de los estados estamos brindando. Entonces, la idea es que a través de USAID y del Congreso y de otros departamentos administrativos de la administración, podríamos hacerlos, si es necesario, ver la película, y esto es lo que hemos estado haciendo en Washington. Roberto y Lada acaban de mostrar la película al senior staff de varios congresistas, y bueno, como cualquier persona que mira esa película, se quedaron muy impresionados. Entonces, la idea es hacerlos saber de lo que está pasando y tratar de usar el porcentaje del dinero en la iniciativa Mérida que está designado para ir para estos mejoramientos, de mandar un poquito de transparencia y decir lo están logrando, lo están cambiando, y tratar de implementar lo que yo dije antes, que es eso de filmación de las interrogaciones y de todos los jurados criminales, que es lo que se hace aquí en los estados, que es lo que hay que hacer.
Gracias. Y cuando yo estaba viendo la película, una de las cosas que sentí era que el problema era tan complicado y que necesitaba como una solución legislativa en México y también en los Estados Unidos. Gracias por compartir que algo está pasando en ese nivel, pero también si ¿qué pueden hacer los radios escuchas o personas sin acceso a los legislativos unas veces para primeramente ver el documental y también para participar en la campaña?
Sí, es una excelente pregunta, y como he dicho, todos deben ver la película, es buenísima. Es en español con subtítulos en inglés, entonces cualquier persona que habla estos dos idiomas lo puede entender y ver. Si ustedes van al sitio en el internet de la película, que es presuntoculpable.org, presuntoculpable.org, pueden ver el link y pueden ver el enlace para poder ir a ver la película. Eventualmente, no ahorita, eventualmente se va a poder pedir copias del DVD. Ahorita PBS, la estación pública, tiene una forma de mandar copias, y ustedes pueden ver eso también en el sitio del internet. Pero sobre todo, lo que estamos tratando de hacer y lo que como realmente queremos lograr es hacer una presentación pública de esa película en México. O sea, buscar distribuidores para poner la película en el cine, sí, el cine normal, en cualquier ciudad en México. Y en eso estamos. Y para eso, como ustedes se imaginan, se ocupa dinero. Porque documentales históricamente no hacen mucho dinero. No son el gran éxito comercial. No es una película de Arnold Schwarzenegger o lo que sea. O como dicen, Arnold Abecedario, esto dice mi esposo, por decir Arnold Schwarzenegger, que es hondureño. Entonces, si ustedes van a este mismo sitio del internet o buscan en Facebook Presunto Culpable o Presumed Guilty, que es el título en inglés, pueden hacerse fanático de esa película y de la causa, y pueden contribuir su tiempo, sus ideas, sus historias, si tienen una historia propia o de un familiar o amigo de haber estado en la situación de Tonio. Entonces todo eso nos ayuda para presentar el caso, y esperamos que en diciembre, eso es la meta, esperamos que en diciembre esa película esté en todos los cines, en todas las ciudades grandes de México, y que cualquier persona que puede comprar boleto puede ver la película.
Bueno, ese es todo el tiempo que tenemos ahorita. Muchas gracias por lo que nos ha enseñado a nosotros el video, y también usted, sus palabras, y por venir acá. Y si quieren ver el documental otra vez, pueden ir a pbs.com y el website, no, presuntoculpable.org, para más información. Vamos a seguir con el programa Relato Zapatista aquí en 104.1 FM, y regresamos con noticias de Califatzlán y Arizona cuando regresamos.
Capitanes. enredado por los cuellos, y paliacate rojo, enredado por los cuellos. Ellos tienen buenas armas y parque para pelear, más con demás sargentos que te saben pelear.
Zapatista on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1. And we would like to remind our listeners again that if you feel like calling in with questions or comments and would like to discuss with us, the number is 510-495-1666. And right now we're going to go to musical break, and then we will come back with a discussion around Arizona.
El 29 de julio, en más de 70 ciudades de los Estados Unidos, hubo manifestaciones y protestas en contra de la implementación oficial de la ley SB 1070, que fue firmada por la gobernadora de Arizona, Jan Brewer, unos meses antes. En todo el país, la gente gritó y se movilizó para expresar la rabia que sentimos todos contra la injusticia y el racismo de la policía y el Estado en contra de nuestras comunidades marginadas. Aquí en el área de la Bahía de San Francisco, participamos en una manifestación en solidaridad con el pueblo de Arizona y en contra de las leyes racistas que criminalizan la migración. En la víspera de la implementación formal de la ley y las manifestaciones planeadas para el mismo día, una corte federal declaró que partes de la ley eran ilegítimas, temporalmente bloqueándolas. Algunos interpretaron esta decisión como una victoria, mientras que la mayoría insistieron en la necesidad de seguir luchando en contra de lo que queda de SB 1070 y otras leyes parecidas como la SCOM o Secure Communities Program, que requiere que la policía local cooperen con la migra, registrando a cada individuo parado por cualquier delito, desde las violaciones más mínimas, así dándole a la migra acceso ilimitado a los registros locales y facilitando la persecución y deportación de más migrantes. En decenas de ciudades como Miami, Atlanta, Washington, Boston y Chicago, la gente tomó las calles para manifestarse en contra de la política migratoria y económica del gobierno estadounidense, cristalizado en el contexto extremo de Arizona. Las movilizaciones incluyeron marchas, mitines, ocupaciones y bloqueos de carreteras y puentes. En Nueva York, miles de personas salieron a las calles y marcharon exigiendo la revocación de SB 1070 y reforma migratoria comprensiva por parte de la administración de Barack Obama. La marcha en Nueva York llegó a bloquear el famoso puente de Brooklyn durante más de 2 horas. En Los Ángeles, más de 50,000 personas marcharon en la ciudad que muchos consideran una ciudad latinoamericana por la enorme población de migrantes ahí. En la tarde, un grupo de manifestantes bloquearon la calle principal de Wilshire Boulevard, utilizando una táctica que vemos cada vez más en protestas en los Estados Unidos. Varias caravanas de solidaridad llevaron gente de Los Ángeles a Arizona para participar en las protestas ahí. En Arizona, miles y miles de personas marcharon en Phoenix con protestas dirigidas a las oficinas del sheriff Joe Arpaio, el infame jefe de la policía del condado de Maricopa, que incluye la ciudad de Phoenix. Arpaio ha implementado políticas muy cuestionables en los últimos años, brutalmente criminalizando a migrantes y latinos en Phoenix. Decenas de personas fueron arrestadas en las protestas en frente de sus oficinas y en total más de 70 personas fueron arrestadas en Phoenix el día de jueves. En Tucson, al sur de Phoenix, también hubo grandes protestas y en la mañana un grupo de personas bloquearon la carretera Interestatal 19. En el comunicado que difundieron explican esta acción. Cito: en la mañana que la SB 1070 está programada para entrar en vigor en el estado de Arizona y tres días antes de que Obama despliegue a 1,200 tropas de la Guardia Nacional, un grupo de miembros comunitarios bloquearon el tráfico hacia la I-19, sur de la calle Ajo en Tucson, Arizona. Un bloqueo de llantas cubiertas con alquitrán y vidrio quebrado fueron colocadas en los dos carriles que van hacia el sur. En la carretera se ubicó un cartelón que declara: alto a toda la militarización, la frontera es ilegal. Este bloqueo es un paro temporal de la misma carretera que es usada para deportar a personas consideradas ilegales, al igual que es una interrupción directa del flujo de los productos y mercancía. Al interrumpir el tráfico de la I-19, hemos logrado suspender el transporte de inmigrantes y las ganancias que empresas como Walking Hood y Corrections Corporation of America ganan al cumplir actos inhumanos como separar a nuestras familias. Esta mañana nosotros interrumpimos la privatización de la criminalización de las comunidades de color. Fin de cita del comunicado. Esta acción simbólica acabó sin ningún arresto, aunque en otras partes de la ciudad de Tucson sí hubo detenciones de más de una docena de manifestantes. Aquí en el norte de California, en nuestra comunidad de la Bahía de San Francisco, participamos en una protesta en el barrio de La Misión.
La ley es aquí y en China las cambia quien se organiza. Si así la quiere, pues me voy. Paso del norte, que lejos te vas quedando. Tu división
para demostrar nuestro coraje y para decir que estos racistas no van a pasar sobre nuestros cuerpos, independientemente de las leyes que pasen o no pasen. Nosotros somos un solo pueblo, una unidad, y así vamos a pertenecer a lo que vamos a la siguiente generación. Nosotros nos quedaremos en este país todos juntos. Recordemos eso. Seamos fuertes, valientes y corajudos como siempre hemos sido. Y recordemos siempre que somos un pueblo unido, una sola comunidad. Y no podemos vender a aquellos que no tienen papeles por la tranquilidad y comodidad del individualismo propio. O somos todos o no es ninguno, compañeros.
Cientos de personas de varias organizaciones y colectivos militantes salieron a la calle para manifestarse en contra de la ley SB 1070 y en solidaridad con migrantes en Arizona y en todo el país. Pudimos hablar con algunos de los manifestantes para escuchar un poco sobre sus motivos para estar ahí en la protesta.
My name is Naomi. I'm with National Alliance for Filipino Concerns.
Okay. And so what brings you out here today to this SB 1070 protest?
We're just just here in solidarity with other community organizations, other community groups who oppose SB 1070. Even, you know, with them launching it today, we just think that this is, we've already seen what has happened, like the small stories that have come out, and that's just the tip of the iceberg of the potential just moral and illegal ramifications of immoral and illegal ramifications of this law. Its possibility of spreading throughout the country is a really big threat to immigrant communities, and so we have to stop it now, even if it were in California, even if you're in New York or Alaska. We all have to contribute to addressing this issue and stopping SB 1070. A lot of folks have already been victimized by this. People that that are even like citizens have been racially profiled, and we just think that it just needs to be stopped. And even if for folks that are undocumented, we really want to address the issue of undocumented folks in this country, we need to look at the foreign policy and the things that are causing people to leave their home countries.
Okay, so the Chinese Progressive Association is set in Chinatown, and we work to fight against like issues that affect the Chinese immigrant working class. And a lot of times we get like the Chinese immigrant community, people don't see like different issues that go on, such as like the housing issues in Chinatown itself. We're like supporting the issue and trying to show that like, you know, all of us are affected by these things, and it does affect like the Chinese community as well. And we're just here standing in solidarity with the other communities that are affected, and just trying to mobilize.
Nosotros, porque si no los ayudamos, pues no hay fuerza de nada.
Sí, sí. Y eso es la lucha contra el miedo también, ¿no? Así, cuando sabemos que estamos juntos en eso, sí. Así se arma. Sí, bien, bien. Y pues, ¿qué esperanza tienen después de un día así con protestas en toda la nación?
Pues, de verdad que se recupere esto, pues tal vez así se mejoran más los trabajos, les den más oportunidad a los trabajadores, más todas las personas, pues todos lo necesitamos.
Estamos aquí porque queremos que esa ley que se ha hecho en Arizona es mentirosa, es racista, es contra los derechos humanos. Y esa ley se debe abolir, o sea, se debe borrar, no más. Y por eso estamos aquí, porque ayer parcialmente se ha borrado algunos puntos y queremos que se borre todo, no una parte.
Secure Communities is an initiative that's like nationwide. Basically, it's a program in which like people who get booked into county jail gets run through a federal database from Homeland Security that identifies whether or not they have their immigration documents in order. So basically, it's a collaboration between ICE and the police in an effort to deport quote-unquote illegal immigrants. So obviously, we're opposed to this initiative. Because it not only gives police more power to say, for example, if you have like day laborers who are looking for employment, police can charge them with loitering, and before they're even charged and ticketed with loitering, their name is run through the database, and they can be arrested, detained, or deported. So that's why it's fucked up.
Entonces, ¿usted está aquí vendiendo camisetas o regalando?
Estamos donando. Estamos pidiendo una mínima donación de la que la gente quiera.
Ándale.
Porque pues los hicimos para básicamente extender la palabra, pues, pura huerta. Pues.
Sí, sí, sí. ¿Y qué dicen las playeras que tienen?
Dicen, explican la ley detrás de la camisa. Ajá. Y en el frente tienen 5 frases positivas diferentes. Okay. Preguntando que si tienen papel, como esa que dice got papers. Ajá. La agarramos como preguntándose a la gente, pues, que la gente se haga la pregunta de que got papers, o como, like, questioning, you know, just anybody que pueda verlos o que los vea.
Ok. ¿Y las otras qué dicen?
Pues, dicen otra de, no, don't legalize racial profiling. Otra we're all, I'm a citizen from planet Earth, because basically we're all from the planet, you know, we're all humans, so we're all from planet Earth.
Okay.
And otra dice también, don't make California a Nazi zone, because I heard, like, that idea came to my mind when I heard that in the news, I heard that they wanted to bring the law, you know, they wanted to extend the law everywhere. But that's why it came to my mind.
Había la presencia visual de muchos carteles hechos por un colectivo de artistas de la zona de Fruitvale en Oakland, reflejando el artivismo, como se dice, que se ha visto muy claramente desde el inicio de las movilizaciones en solidaridad con Arizona. Una mujer de Oakland nos habló un poco del cartel que llevaba.
Tell us a little bit about the sign that you're holding.
Okay, so this sign is actually created by Dignidad y Rebelde. So there's two organizers that I'm familiar with, and they're Chewy and Melanie, and they're based in the Fruitvale area of Oakland. Okay. They do a lot of wonderful work towards geared towards social justice. Uh-huh. They do a lot of silk screen posters and a lot of shirts they generated. You might have seen they have, like, the ones that are promoted right now, like the Brown and Proud uh-huh. shirts, and, you know, Go Against SB 1070. There's other prints that they do, but they're really famous for that, and they're really out in the community doing things for people.
Great.
These were all given free to people in the Fruitvale area, which is where I came from.
Okay, right on. Could you read the sign to us?
So the sign says,
can't see.
Yeah, the sign says, "We will not comply. July 29th, 2010, resist and join in solidarity with Arizona." And on the bottom it says, "Don't work, don't buy, don't comply. No compre, no trabaje, no cumple."
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Más tarde, del otro lado de la bahía, en el centro de Oakland, hubo un concierto con varios artistas de hip hop, la mayoría de ellos latinos. Aunque el evento no fue programado específicamente para coincidir con las protestas, se sentía mucha preocupación por parte de los artistas y del público en cuanto a lo que está sucediendo en Arizona. Hablé con dos de los artistas, el hip hopero mexicano Boca Floja y el hip hopero de Watsonville, Cambio, sobre cómo ven la situación.
Bueno, pienso que es súper importante que la gente se haga presencia en todo sentido en las calles, a nivel tratar de generar un poco de ruido mediático, porque lo que está sucediendo en Arizona es sencillamente fascismo, no hay otra forma de definirlo, es bien complicado, es un exterminio sistémico bien fuerte, bien poderoso, y el problema de esto es que pueda replicarse y pueda tener ese efecto de réplica en diferentes estados, y eso va a ser brutal y dramático. Es una especie de exterminio bien fuerte al que la gente no puede quedarse callada. Es importante que la gente se manifieste y salga a la calle. Sí, es una forma de criminalizar en base a al origen de las personas, ¿no? Y es consecuencia de un sistema racista histórico que ha llegado al punto de legitimar su racismo de una forma aparentemente sutil, que digo, de sutil no tiene nada, ¿no?
No.
Y es súper súper fuerte el hecho de que están dándole un golpe tremendo a todas esas familias que están tratando de luchar por su vida, buscarse una vida diferente, sin cometer absolutamente ningún acto más que el tratar de perseguir la sobrevivencia. Entonces, es importante que la gente a todos niveles, como los activistas de siempre, como la gente a nivel del barrio, se sensibilice y deje un poco la apatía a un lado y tratar de sumarse a un movimiento de resistencia más activo, no pasivo, y esperar a que de algún modo las cosas se moderen, ¿no? O sea, esperar a ver qué pasa.
Que tomen la forma más adecuada para el contexto, ¿no? Entonces puede ser una forma creativa de, pues, movimiento artístico. Vimos hoy en San Francisco un montón de carteles, pues, como pósteres, ¿no? De litografía hechos por un grupo de artistas aquí de Oakland, distribuidos a todos los que estaban en la manifestación, ¿no? Que es como una forma de arte visual, como de ese tipo de como confrontación visual, ¿no?
Eso que mencionas es importante. Creo que es deber de nosotros el tratar de implementar nuevas formas de lucha, nuevas formas que involucren nueva gente, nuevas ideas, nuevas cabezas, tratar de reinventar un poco esa forma de resistir, esa forma de crear, de modo que podamos construir puentes con gente que no siempre está involucrada en eso, ¿no? Pienso que uno de los problemas más fuertes que se tiene nosotros como, pues, activistas o gente involucrada en los procesos de politización es el hecho de que a veces los métodos que utilizamos para resistir, para manifestarnos, hay veces que el barrio, que la gente en general tiene un poco de recelo en cuanto a esas formas. Entonces creo que es tiempo ahora de reinventar esa forma de luchar, de modo que podamos traer más gente y podamos hacer acciones más efectivas con mucha creatividad, ¿no? Y utilizando las herramientas del nuevas del sistema, ¿no?
Pues, claro, sí. Pues estamos aquí en Downtown Oakland con
Boca Floja.
Ándale, muchísimas gracias y pues seguimos mañana en San José.
I think today is like significant that people recognize and come together finally and see that these laws have kind of always really existed, and now that it's in our face, you know, like a lot of people are surprised, but at the same time it's been happening for hundreds of years, I guess you can say. So it's important that people from different communities come together, show solidarity, and have a discourse that has different approaches, like finally, whether it's through music or other alternative forms. So, and I'm really glad to see like a lot of people, and artists too, come together like and show love for what's happening, because I mean, it's fucking crazy. Like.
Shit's really heavy, and today we saw in San Francisco a lot of folks with the posters made by an Oakland-based artist collective that's doing these screen prints, you know, and handing out hundreds of posters for free at manifestations and demonstrations, you know, with the Brown and Proud and the I Will Not Comply posters, you know, and so really seeing the artistic dimension of the protests against SB 1070 and also against the Secure Communities Act, which is affecting us nationally, which, you know, has really only come to light in the last few days as people are really talking about it. So what do you see as sort of the way that hip-hop in particular can sort of intervene in this?
I think it's funny because we're in Oakland, and I think of a story of Tupac, and one of the times that he first got beat down was that the police had stopped him and asked him for identification here in Oakland, and he refused to show identification. He said, you know, I don't need papers, it's not, you know, apartheid, and he got beat down for it. So I think as a hip-hop person, you know, you look at him and some of the steps that he took back in the 90s, and this is like 20 years later, and to see, you know, people still asking for our papers, you know, we should ask Columbus back in the day, what's your papers, you know, and like different people like that. So, I mean, honestly, hip-hop, you had Pac doing it back in the day, you have a lot of artists that are committed to the idea of concrete change and, you know, really talking a lot of shit and bringing it to people's faces, you know, in general. So, and like Pac said, you know, like, first couple times I'm gonna be knocking on the door lightly, and the next time I'm gonna like bang down the door and demand justice and change. So,
So again, we're here with
Cambio, Quilombo Arte.
Right on. Cambio, part of the Quilombo Arte Collective and part of Para la Gente out of Watsonville, California. Thank you so much.
El 29 de julio vimos las acciones del pueblo digno y rebelde y escuchamos atentamente las voces que se levantaron para decir ya basta con la política racista, injusta y neocolonialista que domina los Estados Unidos y que amenaza a nuestras comunidades y nuestras familias. Seguimos caminando juntos en la lucha para los derechos de los migrantes y aquí en Relatos Zapatistas seguiremos reportando sobre este proceso.
Boca floja, cambió, DJ Etos. Let it go, barely beat the buzz of another victory born. It's nothing but net, and the crowd going crazy. Have lose 7-9, have not to win 80. Feel like a champion, Peter Tosh playing the people's anthem. It's like number 21, it's for the Black Panthers. Call it 68 on the podium with a race fist. I feel like Tony Smith, you better get used to this, cause I'm fresh. Dressed like $1 million, threw on my white tee and my P-Rod dunks. Damn. They ask me, Gambio, what's the occasion? Can't you tell I escaped the plantations? I'm from the race of brass, how am I supposed to act? Moms gave me gun and told me it's time to fight back. Fact, I never learned my place, and now I'm in your face. Now say my name, cause the people want change.
Yes, yes, yes.
lo mínimo con su estrategia cínica del amor propio y la confianza con el miedo y una excusa bíblica. Quiero acabar con esa mierda e inyectar orgullo con pregones sin los colores de banderas que no representan mis colores. Quiero brillar y verme bien sin que al complejo de la masa le parezca sospechoso. Gritar que soy el uno sin que el dos esté celoso. Seguirte dando cátedra en el curso, filoso en el discurso, sin parecer curioso el antropólogo y su pulso. Decirte bien seguro que soy grande, sin ego que me opaque, sin individualismo que me alcance. Le doy el justo peso a mi presencia, a la tuya en consecuencia. Que el mundo reconozca dignamente mi existencia, que el mundo reconozca dignamente tu existencia, sí. El mundo nos pertenece, yo no voy a callar, no. El mundo nos pertenece, yo no voy a callar, no.
Back here on Berkeley Liberation Radio. This program is called Relatos Zapatistas. You're listening to 104.1 FM in the East Bay of the Bay Area, Califas. And you can also be streaming us online at berkeleyliberationradio.net. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call in the studio at 510-495-1666 or shoot us an email at relatoszapatistas@gmail.com. We're always really interested to hear any comments from the people who are listening out there in the Bay Area and across the world. We've been talking about in this show, we've called it Boundary Tactics and Trials, the remix. And these are sort of two different topics that we've been talking about in the previous two shows. Boundary tactics, where spaces, borders, walls are used strategically for political purposes, and trials in the sense that thinking about the ways that the legal system can be subverted and used, the sort of doors that it opens, the opportunities that it presents us, and the limitations that those opportunities present us with. And so we've been talking a little bit about in this program with the earlier interview that we did about the documentary Presumed Guilty, Presunto Culpable. There are, you know, some limitations that there are some opportunities and limitations that the legal system in Mexico presents, and you know, the question is, how does a camera, how does an activist, or how does, you know, a protest, or how does a mass movement intervene in those spaces, in those fissures, in those cracks that are left open or unguarded by the legal system? And so in the last show, we were talking about a little bit about the Oscar Grant trial that had been going on at that time. The last show was July 4th. It was before the verdict in the trial of Johannes Messerli, who was the police officer who shot and killed Oscar Grant on January 1st, 2009. It was before the verdict had come out. And just a few days later, the verdict did come out, and there was a big sort of speak out in the street. There was a big protest in the street. Hundreds and hundreds of people came out. Thousands of police came out. And we did an interview with George Chicarello Meyer, who is a member of the Oakland Assembly, just a few days ago. And he talks a little bit about the verdict and, you know, sort of his view of what happened, what's happened, and what is going to be happening in the future in Oakland. So we're going to listen to this interview and sort of thinking about the way that trials and tactics can be used politically. This past week, we sat down with George Chicarello Meyer, a member of the Oakland Assembly that's been organizing around the Oscar Grant murder, and more generally, the issue of police brutality. He shared some thoughts on the verdict, the action in the streets that happened that same night, as well as the state of the Oakland Assembly in itself and in relation to other groups, and some projects that are currently being worked on within that space. The last show that we did was July 4th, so it was before the verdict came out. So, I mean, I guess the first question would be sort of like, what was your impression of the verdict and the aftermath of the verdict?
I think a lot of us in the organizing around Oscar Grant were expecting this verdict from the very beginning, expecting a manslaughter verdict because we knew that would be an easy conviction, but also specifically expecting an involuntary manslaughter verdict because I at least was figuring, you know, if you put yourself in this jury's shoes, once we realized who the jury was composed of, this is a jury that was pro-cop to begin with. Half the people had friends or family members who were police officers. And so put yourself in their shoes and picture them looking at someone who they think of as an honest and upstanding, you know, police officer, and picturing giving them a voluntary manslaughter verdict or a second-degree murder verdict, which would see them behind bars for possibly many years, even on the voluntary manslaughter verdict. So I think we were all expecting this involuntary verdict, and we were hoping and expecting that people would realize that, that this kind of verdict is a joke and a slap in the face and kind of an insult to Oscar Grant, but also to all those who have been, you know, been witnessing and suffering at the hands of police violence for all these years.
So after the verdict was announced, people went out in the streets. There was sort of a big speak out thing, and you know, then the what people are talking about is looting or the riot or whatever. So your thoughts on that?
Sure. We in the Oakland Assembly organized the speak out at 14th and Broadway, and this was a, you know, this is a community organization. It's a directly democratic assembly style organization, and so from the beginning, it's been an organization that hasn't been dominated by, you know, sort of conservative nonprofits. It hasn't been dominated by people who want to come over and take things over because it's, you know, because we work democratically. So we essentially decided to hold a speak out in the intersection at 14th and Broadway. And we also decided, which I think was very important, we decided that it was not our job to tell people how to express their rage and how to express their, you know, their anger or their, you know, frustration or you know, this was before the verdict, so, you know, how to, in the case of a conviction, a murder conviction, how to express their happiness. We weren't going to tell people how they needed to do that. And we decided that at 8 p.m. our event would be over. And it was planned to start at 6. Now, on the day, of course, the verdict came out earlier, and before 5 o'clock, there were already a couple hundred people gathered at 14th and Broadway, and we had said that we weren't going to start until 6. So we had to sort of, you know, move things along and get them going. But still, at 8 o'clock, the speak out, the official speak out, essentially, you know, we packed it up and decided that our official duties were over. And what people, you know, in the assembly did after that, you know, it was really up to them. Some people went home, some people kept an eye on things, some people as individuals tried to defuse potentially dangerous situations and prevent police incursions, but that was really what happened afterward. And to speak on a personal level, you know, I was glad to see people stand up and do things, you know, and I don't, you know, people like to say that looting is a sort of mindless act, but I frankly don't see the problem with people who are not making enough money to buy expensive shoes. I don't see any problem with them taking those shoes back, especially when those shoes are made for, you know, a dollar a day by brown people somewhere else in this world.
You mentioned conservative NGOs, and one of the things that we were talking about in the last show, sort of based on your article, was the tensions that had sort of arisen between some of the grassroots organizers in the Oakland Assembly and other people, and the NGOs, some of the nonprofits that seem to be working with pretty closely with the city government and the police. So I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about the tensions, what form those tensions took, like in the lead up to the verdict, and then what they're sort of looking like now after all that stuff went down.
Sure. And to do that, I would just take it back a year. Essentially, when after Oscar Grant was killed, and if we're talking about, you remember, we're talking about the early rebellions in January of 2009, the 7th, the 14th, and the 30th, what we had at that point, at least on the 7th and the 14th, was an organization called CAPE, which was heavily composed of conservative nonprofits. I say conservative. These are actually so-called radical nonprofits, you know, groups like Youth Uprising, the Ella Baker Center, these sort of organizations that actually have their foundation in and have their origins in radical groups of the 90s, which took a nonprofit turn. What we had in January of 2009 was a coalition called CAPE, which was a more nonprofit-oriented coalition. And that coalition collapsed in large part because of these tensions and because people were repeatedly calling out conservatives in this organization. What we had a year later in the Oakland Assembly and in other organizations organizing around Justice for Oscar Grant was a better, you know, a better constellation of forces. You know, fewer conservative people, fewer liberals, fewer nonprofits. And the divisions then occurred, you know, on more predictable lines, and ones that made the lines of power more obvious, I think. Specifically, when the verdict was coming down, the nonprofits, in a way, knowing that they weren't welcome in the community spaces, a lot of them moved directly into alliance. This wasn't even a subtle alliance. This was an obvious alliance. This was a direct alliance. You know, this alliance of connections by politics and by money with the city government, with Mayor Dellums. Mayor Dellums, of course, being in charge, at least nominally, of the Oakland Police Department. So we had groups like specifically the Urban Peace Movement and Youth Uprising who were issuing some very, you know, very conservative and upsetting calls and demands and issuing certain accusations. And essentially, these two groups, Urban Peace Movement and Youth Uprising, collaborated on a PSA that was released, a video that explicitly, you know, not even subtly, explicitly equated Oscar Grant's death with the breaking of windows after his death. So essentially saying, you know, in their message was violence is not justice, that all so-called violence is the same. We, of course, know that not all violence is the same. The violence of the police and the violence of the state is what creates a situation in which young people often feel that they can only respond by smashing things or only respond by killing their own people. This isn't to justify necessarily the way people respond, but these, you know, from the very jump, these things are not the same thing. But what we had in the positive side of this is that we had a very clear relationship of power between these nonprofits and the state, and I hope that that relationship just gets more and more clear, because it'll make those of us doing community organizing realize that these allies, these so-called allies, are not really allies at all in the nonprofits, and that we need to be very, very careful, because while there may be good people as individuals working for nonprofits, everybody needs a job, that once those people start to confuse that job with their politics, then things really start to get dangerous.
I think the formulation that you have of the sort of clear lines of power between the Oakland Assembly, or sort of grassroots, more like grassroots organizing, and the NGOs and the nonprofits that line up with the state is really interesting. And you sort of mentioned before that the Oakland Assembly was in some ways inspired by the politics of the, you know, Oaxaca Assembly. And so I wonder if you could talk about maybe a little bit about the formation of the Oakland Assembly and sort of some of those, how those ideas inspired the form that the Oakland Assembly took.
Well, I'd say it was around the middle of 2009 when there was a bit of a lull with respect to the question of Oscar Grant. You know, Messerly had been arrested, had been bailed, and then people were essentially waiting for what they knew would be a long and drawn-out trial process. And in the process of brainstorming, a number of organizations came up with the idea of putting forward an assembly structure, because part of what we'd seen was the problem of nonprofits, but another part of what we'd seen was the fact that previous coalitions had been trying to make decisions, you know, with steering committees or behind closed doors, and we thought there would be something beneficial about bringing a directly democratic structure to this struggle in particular, and specifically because we felt as though a lot of the more radical sentiments surging up from below were being shut down once they reached, you know, these sort of undemocratic structures. And we realized that, you know, we weren't in the same situation as Oaxaca. This wasn't a long-term organized movement where the bases had already been built for this kind of radical coalition that would essentially take power in the streets of Oakland. This was not going to happen, but what we saw as something that could contribute to the struggle, even if only for a year or two.
One of the big things that the police and the city government were talking about, and also the some of the nonprofits, before the verdict came out, and I guess after as well, was the idea of like outside agitators coming in from outside of Oakland, and a lot of times the outside agitators were figured as white anarchists, and obviously that's not a useful way of thinking about it, particularly when the police are being brought in from all over the place and getting centralized in downtown Oakland. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the space of the Oakland Assembly and sort of what communities it's drawing on, and think about like why those communities in particular are the ones that are sort of organizing in sort of this vein, and if there are connections between that particular community and other communities in sort of the grassroots organizing.
Sure. I mean, and this outside agitator soundbite is one that's obviously disturbing, but also kind of interesting. And if you look at the history of it, it has its history in the South of the United States. It's it's used by racist, you know, governors to try to prevent people and activists from coming in from other parts of the country to resist segregation. And it's used in a similar way by those in power in Oakland. And if you track the way that it emerged on January 7th of 2009, it was actually the police that created this soundbite about the outside agitators, fed it to the press. The press started to repeat it. And then those organizers who were not on the streets January 7th, the more conservative organizers, essentially started parroting this line because it fit very well with a sort of, in some ways, a really conservative nationalism that was actually quite reformist. And obviously, you know, the city has a lot to gain from using this outside agitator line. It's something which allows them to hide the fact that there is serious discontent within the community, and specifically within the poor, you know, black and brown community that is not represented in city government, despite the fact that the mayor may or may not be black. Now, the Oakland Assembly has been at least partially successful in drawing in a mix of not just ethnicities, but a mix of people, you know, what you could call directly community members who were not organizing before, were not involved in organizing, and people who have been organizing for a long time. You know, there are anarchists, there are communists, there are black nationalists, there are a whole series of groups of people that come together and work in this group precisely because I think they they like the democratic functioning of the assembly, but they also dislike the way that other groups have worked in the past, and specifically community members, because in the past, if you went to a CAPE meeting and you were a community member, there was very little you could accomplish. Everything was being done by professional activists who, if they weren't making decisions behind closed doors, which they were, even then a community member would not necessarily know the lingo that was being used, would not know how the rules of participation, you know, whether it be, you know, twiddling your fingers or, you know, dividing into subcommittees or you know, speaking in certain languages that only an activist community uses regardless of its color. I think we've been partially successful in bringing people into the assembly. As I said, in the comparison to the question of Oaxaca, I mean, this is a limited success because this is not a community that's been, you know, fully mobilized to participate in things like democratic assemblies, so our successes are only partial. And I think what we need is a process of you know, of almost base building and more direct participation on the community level, not necessarily a general assembly structure, but on a sort of hood by hood, neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block level, to help, you know, develop structures which can replace police, you know, which can replace the government, and which can allow people who live there locally to actually make decisions that have an effect on their lives.
So talking about these sort of future projects or this kind of vision, I mean, obviously that stuff seems pretty far in the future. What is the Oakland Assembly like talking about doing now, sort of in the near future? Clearly we've seen, like, with another murder happening right after the verdict was announced of another black person from Oakland at the hands of BART and Oakland police together, you know, just a few days after the verdict, we've seen that not only is the police not accountable, but that all the overtures that the city government have been making and sort of all these different organizations have been making aren't having that much effect. So what are some of the next steps in the near future?
Well, the biggest challenge, and this has been the challenge from the beginning, is to figure out how to relate the question of Oscar Grant to the question of police violence and racism and genocide more broadly. How to leap from organizing around the death of Oscar Grant in the trial, which is, you know, a timeline that's created by the state and which is in some ways out of our hands, and something that we create on our own. You know, what kind of, you know, how can we make this transition? How can we make this leap? In the aftermath of the trial and the verdict, at least, there is an energy. The Oakland Assembly met the week after the verdict came in, and there were probably between 100 and 150 people showed up to this massive assembly meeting, people just sort of like dying to get involved in this organizing. And the immediate process consisted in creating committees to do specific kinds of work. We have a committee that's dedicated to working on the question of Domenici and Peroni, the other BART officers who were on the platform and who ended up being fired, and holding them responsible, you know, and bringing them to trial, and specific tactics that could be used in doing that. We have a committee that was formed to defend those in the legal process who were swept up on the evening of the verdict. We have committees formed to do, as I said, this local outreach in communities that have not been able to come into the assembly yet to attempt to draw, especially young people of color, into this organizing, whether it be through cultural activities, et cetera. We have a sort of an artistic propaganda committee that's been formed whose goal is actually to turn Oakland into a political landscape in a way that it has not yet, you know, been. And so there will be a lot of wheat pasting campaigns, art campaigns, music. And so these are the sorts of activities that are going on. There's an assembly meeting essentially every 2 weeks, usually on Thursday night, at 7 p.m. at the Continental Club, which is at Campbell and 12th in West Oakland. It's just a few blocks north and a few blocks west from the BART. And, you know, and that's usually listed. It's irregular, but it's usually every 2 weeks, and it's listed more or less on Indie Bay. You know, this is something that we really encourage people to come and plug into.
En cualquier sociedad, las aspiraciones de una parte de sus miembros chocan abiertamente con las aspiraciones de otros, que la vida social está llena de contradicciones, que la historia nos muestra una lucha entre pueblos y sociedades, así como en su propio seno. Todo el mundo sabe también que se suceden los periodos de revolución y de reacción, de paz y de guerra, de estancamiento y de rápido progreso o decadencia. Vladimir Lenin. Caído el muro, se encuentran las ciudades. Los buenos y los malos juzgarán sus criminales. Caído el muro, el pan no se reparte. Se vende la conciencia y nuestras voluntades. No queda un muro de acero en el alma, como si un pavimento, una fuerza de cara. Quedará inmune el que jure bandera. Tendrá su cuota al final de la guerra. Quedan el hambre, queda el embray y el hombre. Quedan rufianes matando en mi nombre. Queda una isla en la esquina del Caribe, presa del tiempo y ni muge ni embiste. Se peina, se viste, morena decide. La baña el sol y el mar, pero viste. Queda una prisa, se me quedó la rabia. Por la tierra de siempre me sobra la gana. Ya no hay poema, ni sueño, verde olivo, ni árboles de fuego, ni frutos prohibidos. Mas sin embargo lucho por lo que digo. Lo tuyo es tuyo, lo mío es mío. Visto colores en los muros de la urbe. Letras colores, negros, rojos, azules.
y sigo inmune, me levanto a la izquierda, detrás del muro, de frente a la derecha. Para mañana, ajustarte la corbata, pedir perdón a tiempo antes que llegue el alba. Comprar manuales de hacerse el pendejo y ser tecnócrata, perito en derecho. Legislador, profesor, dirigente, al tope y aquí clamando a la gente. Con calma piensa, no ves que el horizonte de una isla es redondo y cercado por el norte. ¿Qué hacer ahora? Darse larga la vista, quedarse en casa, leerse la Biblia. Meterse a hippie, fumar de la pipa, salvar el planeta sembrando rodillas. ¿Qué nos queda? Nos queda las ganas, por la tierra y su gente, ¿qué hacer mañana? Guardar silencio, depositarlo al banco hasta que esté de moda a los revolucionarios. Reproducirnos, vendernos, destruirnos, traicionar, perdonarnos, en la cara escupirnos. Hacernos templos con ídolos de piedra, jurar bandera por 30 monedas. Publicar libros en los supermercados hasta que esté de moda a los revolucionarios. Hacer la yoga, meterse a budista, comerse el pan, saberse la Biblia. ¿Qué hacer ahora? ¿Qué queda? Lo que queda, nos queda una cortina de hierro en la cabeza. Caído el muro al final de la guerra, con todo el frío y dolor que nos deja. Pinto colores en los muros de la urbe, letras colores.
You are listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio on 104.1 FM. We're here every first Sunday of the month from 4 to 6 p.m. And our next segment is... Durito, is that you? Is Durito Story Hour. Coming up next on Berkeley Liberation Radio, this is Relato Zapatista.
Rising over the horizon, it's hard to start writing. Been fighting in the belly of the titan, tying tourniquets tight and around the middle of thine. My pen floods the pages while the children are crying. I want to put on an iron shirt, chase the devil out of earth, spit until my tongue and saliva glands burst. But first, I invoke the spirit of the long gone and coming back. Through the song, I am one with that all-seeing being. But it seems as if we're being tricked into believing that which we think we believe in. Even if we disagree on who the best MC is, we bob to the beat as if we're nodding in agreement. I write to freedom, though freedom hasn't come, I let it ring to leave a message on my answering machine. I see a movement has begun as soon as we become the truth.
For this month's Durito Story Hour, we are going to be reading a communique entitled Durito Number 6, Neoliberalism, Chaotic Theory of Economic Chaos, and we will be just reading a selection of this communique. Durito states, but there's something that gives coherency to all the government's incoherence. I've been analyzing several clues. I read all of the cabinet's declarations. I classified all of its actions and omissions. I contrasted their political histories. I requested and obtained even their least important acts and arrived at a very important conclusion. Durito stops, taking an air to give himself importance, and lengthens the pause. So I will ask, and what is that conclusion? Elementary, my dear Watson. There's an invisible element in the cabinet, a character that, without making itself known, gives coherence to and makes systemic all the braying of the government team, a boss to whose command everyone submits, Zedillo included. That is to say, X exists, the real governor of the country in question. But who is the mysterious character X, I ask, unable to hide the shiver that runs up my spine as I imagine that it might be Salinas? Something worse, says Durito, arranging his papers. Worse than Salinas? Who is he? Negative. It's not a he. It's a she, says Durito, puffing on his pipe. A she. Correct. Her first name is Stupid, and her last name is Improvisation. And I take note that I say Stupid Improvisation. Because you should know, my dear Watson, that there are intelligent improvisations. But this isn't the case here. Miss X is a stupid improvisation, neoliberalism in politics. Neoliberalism made political doctrine. That is to say, stupid improvisation, administering the destinies of the country and of others. Argentina and Peru, for example. So you're insinuating that Menem and Fujimori are the same as... I'm not insinuating anything. I'm affirming it. Just as the Argentine and the Peruvian workers. I was analyzing Yeltsin when my tobacco ran out. Yeltsin. But wasn't it the Mexican government cabinet you were analyzing? No, not only the Mexican one. Neoliberalism, as you should know, my dear Watson, is a plague that afflicts all of humanity, like AIDS. Of course, the Mexican political system has an enchanting stupidity that is difficult to resist. But nevertheless, all of these governments that are ravaging the world have something in common. All of their success is based on a lie, and therefore, its base is only as solid as the bench you're sitting on. I get up instinctively, examine the bench of logs and reeds we've constructed, and make sure it's solid and firm. Now more relieved, I tell Dorito. But let's suppose, my dear Sherlock, that the bad guys are able to maintain their lie for an indefinite period of time, that the false base remains solid, and they keep harvesting success. Dorito doesn't let me continue. He interrupts me with an impossible. The foundation of neoliberalism is a contradiction. In order to maintain itself, it must devour itself, and therefore destroy itself. That's why there are political assassinations, underhanded blows, contradictions between the acts and the statements of public functionaries at every level, battles between interest groups and everything else that keeps stockbrokers up at night. They used to keep them up at night. I think now they're getting used to it because the stock market is on the rise, I say with some skepticism. It's a bubble. It will burst before too long. Mark my words, says Dorito as he smiles with a know-it-all air and continues. What keeps the systems going is what will bring it down. It's elementary. All you have to do is read G.K. Chesterton's The Three Horsemen of the Apocalypse to understand it. It's a detective story, but as well known, life ends up imitating art. Sounds to me like your theory is pure I hadn't finished speaking as I sat down on the log bench. It collapsed with the muffled sound of my bones hitting the ground, and not so muffled curse, I uttered. Dorito laughs as he's about to choke when he comes down in a bit and says, you were going to say that my theory is pure fantasy. Fine, as you can appreciate from your current lowly position, life proves me right. History and the people will also give their 2 cents worth. Dorito considers his talk over and lies back against the newspaper clippings. I don't even try to get up. I pull my backpack over and get comfortable again. We stay silent, watching how, to the east, as honey and wheat pour through between the legs of the mountain, we sigh. What else could we do? Vale, salud. And may neither history nor the people take too long. El soup with a tender pain in his side.
Of an eye, I did you to try to test I and I been destined to fly, but I'm resting tonight. And one bright morning I will take flight. But until then, I'll be rocking on the M. I see the future dripping out of a pen. And if sleep be the cousin of death, then every time I glitch one step closer to my last breath. They said talk is cheap, but war is expensive. I speak cause it's free and these words are my weapon. Don't think for a second, I will not question U.S. foreign policy, imperial aggression, inventing war for the quenching of the thirst for the oil. Cause money don't trickle down to workers who toil. You see, blood trickle down from the womb to the soil.
Están escuchando Relatos Zapatistas en Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1. Berkeley Liberation Radio.net en el internet. Tenemos un minuto más para concluir esta sesión de Relatos Zapatistas. Estamos aquí yo, DJ Alita, DJ Que La Lucha Sigue, DJ Filemón y DJ Profe. Now, this is Berkeley Liberation Radio, Relatos Zapatistas. We're here every first Sunday of the month from 4 to 6 p.m. You can also search for our archives on indiebay.org. We encourage you all to email us at any time with any comments, suggestions, critiques, inspirations at relatoszapatistas@gmail.com. We are wrapping up the show here. We're going to go with a final song to fade out here, and we thank you all for joining us today. Again, Relatos Zapatistas on Berkeley Liberation Radio.
Somos los polos magnéticos. Los témpanos de fuego, por los que orbitan sonidos y giran versos. Rompecabezas de las piezas del pasado. Un hormiguero de obreros en sindicato. Parecen tantos como tropas de elefantes que van para adelante cruzando por los Alpes. Parecen niños palestinos al ataque, tirando piedras como un David al gigante. Parecen tanques aplastando regimientos. Una guerrilla de acróbatas del cemento, francotirando a la ignorancia de lo alto, incrementando niveles representando. Si mis palabras y mi flow fueran de piedra, zumbo peñones del tamaño del planeta. Si mis canciones fueran himnos a la nada, fueran regatas de papel y mi palabra, que es impermeable, un acero inoxidable. Un portaaviones en misiones de combate, serían menudas y minúsculas partículas. Estas canciones fueran signos cavernícolas, estatuas de sal, portales de goma. Serían el himno nacional de Gomorra. Estampa fotos de la farsa y del vicio. Serían plomazos directo al precipicio. Estos son toros de holocausto en sacrificio. Son rascacielos estas torres que edifico. Son ejercicios de la lógica y de métrica. Para llegar me necesitas escalera. Estas canciones son cantones comunistas. Son astilleros, gatilleros sandinistas. Son vietnamitas caminando bajo tierra. Esta es la ruta Ho Chi Minh de
de la conciencia.
Del Ártico al Antártico, del Índico al Atlántico, seguimos aplastando lo sintético y lo plástico, y sigo enfático y más revolucionario.